So as one of our friends remarked to me just a few moments ago, you can talk about just about anything you want from a spiritual context, except money. And there's no way around it, friends. This week, our Haftarah is exclusively, almost explicitly about money. It's chosen because it talks so much about money. And it coincides with a really important moment in the liturgical calendar in a leap year. Every 5 years in the Jewish calendar, we have what's called this particular special Shabbat, Shabbat Shekalim, where a normal parsha is actually split in two, or you can imagine two parsha that are normally fused, finally get unfused. And instead of reading this parsha for today, Hayakhel, and he assembled, with next week's parsha, Pikudei, they are split apart. And in fact, we go back in time and reread part of last week's parsha. In fact, it's the beginning of last week's parsha. And I'm going to open today by just reading that to y'all and trying to make sense of why on earth we are getting spun around like this in the timeline. Hopefully to see, as John just prayed over us, that God is ever bringing our attention back to the fact that we don't truly, finally own things. We are part of God's glorious creation that are under his guidance and care. And he temporarily places other things within our guidance and care. And that's where we find ourselves in Exodus 30. So I'm going to share my screen in case that helps y'all to follow along just a little bit. Just by nodding your heads, you can see this highlighted portion, atonement money. Fantastic. This is from Exodus chapter 30. Again, this is the beginning of last week's Parsha, and yet it's cycled back through for this week. Starting in verse 11. Then the Lord said to Moses, "When you take a census of the Israelites to count them, each one must pay the Lord a ransom for his life at the time he's counted. Then no plague will come on them when you number them. Each one who crosses over to those already counted is to give a half shekel." That's nothing in today's money. "According to the sanctuary shekel, which weighs 20 gerahs." In those days, this was quite a bit. "This half shekel is an offering to the Lord. All who cross over, those 20 years old or more, are to give an offering to the Lord. The rich are not to give more than a half shekel, and the poor are not to give less when you make the offering to the Lord to atone for your lives. Receive the atonement money from the Israelites and use it for the service of the Tent of Meeting. It will be a memorial for the Israelites before the Lord, making atonement for your lives." Brothers and sisters, this is the word of the Lord. And yet, in a normal year, we would find ourselves five chapters further on in Exodus 35, from chapters 35 to 38. And in normal years, our big themes, the lenses with which we want to read this parsha, are going to be themes of Shabbat, which before I found out about this year's odd timing, I had a bunch of fun stories to tell you guys about Shabbat and fun questions to ask, but we'll simply come to those later on in the Torah. Another big theme is to read in light of the temple, because we're given the materials for the tabernacle. We're told about Bezalel, his artistry, and Oholiab, and what they did to craft the vessels for the temple. We have the tabernacle at the time, later to be revealed in the temple. We have a description of the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant and the table and the lampstand, the altar of incense, the altar of burnt offerings. We get this beautiful, pretty descriptive picture of the Tent of Meeting, the tabernacle. And so a normal year's Haftarah will take us into 1 Kings 7, which you might remember we read just a few weeks ago, about Solomon's dedication of the great temple in Jerusalem. And those themes are very clear. So what on earth are we doing stepping back and away from this primary source text that should have been in our weekly reading. We're actually preparing ourselves for Purim. I know it sounds a bit odd, but Purim is not too far away. And in this liturgical calendar, we find ourselves on last Saturday, the Shabbat Shekelim, the Sabbath of Shekels. And in this Shabbat Shekelim, it is requested of each adult male Jew to contribute half of a biblical shekel for the upkeep of the tabernacle, also known as the Mishkan. That Torah portion from Exodus 30 is read again, and it takes place at the beginning of the month of Adar, which happens to be this month we've just entered alongside the Roman calendar month of March. And in this special Shabbat, we see ourselves as members of a very tight-knit community, a community that in biblical context is being counted, like literally in a census, and a community where being involved demands something of us, and not only of us, but of each other for our sakes. The rich aren't able, they're not even allowed to give more money to show off their riches. And the poor don't get by with nothing whatsoever. They're all demanded one particular price, half a biblical shekel. And yet we do have reason from the precedent of Passover, you might remember, in Pesach, for a family that can't afford a lamb of its own, special instructions are given for other families to help supply the needs for that household. And so we have no reason to think that that was somehow disallowed here, that there is some back and forth assistance and giving going on in this time of census taking. And it kind of levels the playing field, both spiritually and certainly economically, reminding us that regardless of our economic status, we are occupying pretty similar space in the community as persons and as households. This can be really tough for an American to talk about. Going back to that opening question, what on earth is it about money that makes it so hard to talk about? I think different cultures have, you know, different versions of an answer. But I can certainly speak on behalf of American Protestants. Even still today, we have this undetachable association with the prosperity gospel, with preachers who make 10, 20, 100, 1,000 times an average person's wage by preaching about the good of giving and making sure enough of it lines their pockets later on. Eloquent preachers, some of which actually came from here, one of them from Jaffa, I'll let you look him up if you'd like, who build empires of ministries attached to their name, saying, God will turn this $1, $10, $100, $1,000, he'll turn this tenfold to his glory and make you prosper too. And I have no claim right now to make against the belief that God can multiply, just like Christ multiplies the loaves and the fishes. There's no question as to whether he can. The question is to the motivation behind reminding people that, especially when there's something personal at stake, like your own living expenses or senseless profit. So for Americans who are not caught up in this subculture of prosperity gospel thinking, of treating God like, honestly, like a roulette system in Las Vegas, where we just give a little gamble on it and hope and believe that we're going to hit a jackpot in his kindness. For people who want to disassociate from that, it's really hard to say, oh, by the way, we need money, guys. It is really, really hard to say. In fact, I realized not too long ago that one of the biggest factors in this complex we seem to have in our heads is whether you're asking for yourself or whether you're asking for someone else. And I think a ton of people who are called by God to raise support among his other people around, those who come from money, those who are making more than money than they need, there are people out there who are gifted with the ability to make a big ask, to say, this is something that we need for our ministry, for the poor, for the people that we come in contact with. But I'm not asking for myself, and I won't touch anything that you give. None of it will go to me. So when we ask, and we ask on behalf of someone else, we actually find ourselves patterning off of biblical models. Likewise, in our Haftarah, we find this abnormal, unexpected problem of people actually giving too much. And so there are some really specific commands issued as to what to do with the money problem in the temple. This comes to us from the book of 2 Kings, chapter 12. It says, "In the seventh year of Jehu, Joash became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 40 years. His mother's name was Zibiah. She was from Beersheba. Joash did what was right in the eyes of the Lord all the years Jehoiada the priest instructed him." This is important. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord all those years he was instructed. The high places, however, were not removed. The people continued to offer sacrifices and burn incense there. So we should have two very drastic alarms going off. One is, oh my gosh, a good king? And the second is, how can he be a good king? There are still offerings to idols everywhere. There's no taking down of the high places. So Joash says to the priests in verse 4, "Collect all the money that is brought as sacred offerings to the temple of the Lord, the money collected in the census, the money received from personal vows, and the money brought voluntarily to the temple." This is really important. It's three different kinds of money given for three different purposes. "Let every priest," he says, "receive the money from one of the treasurers, then use it to repair whatever damage is found in the temple." Okay, good. We've got a plan here. "But by the 23rd year of King Joash, the priests still had not repaired the temple." Okay, you can get by with a few months. You can get by with maybe a couple years, but clearly some time has passed. And this is not an acceptable length of waiting. "Therefore, King Joash summoned Jehoiada and the priest, the other priests as well, and asked them, 'Why aren't you repairing the damage done to the temple? Take no more money from your treasurers, but hand it over for repairing the temple.' The priests agreed that they would not collect any more money from the temple, from the people, and they would not repair the temple themselves. Jehoiada the priest took a chest, and he bored a hole in its lid. He placed it beside the altar on the right side as one enters the temple of the Lord. The priests who guarded the entrance put into the chest all the money that was brought to the temple of the Lord. Whenever they saw that there was a large amount of money in the chest, the royal secretary and the high priest came, counted the money that had been brought into the temple of the Lord, and they put it into bags. When the amount had been determined, they gave the money to the men appointed to supervise the work on the temple. With it, they paid those who worked on the temple of the Lord, carpenters and builders, the masons and stonecutters. They purchased timber and blocks of dressed stone for the repair of the temple of the Lord, and they met all the other expenses of restoring the temple. The money brought into the temple was not spent for making silver basins, wick trimmers, sprinkling bowls, trumpets, or any other articles of gold and silver for the temple of the Lord. It was paid to the workers who used it to repair the temple. They did not require an accounting from those to whom they gave the money to pay the workers because they acted with complete honesty. The money from the guilt offerings and sin offerings was not brought into the temple of the Lord, for it belonged to the priests." So what do we have here? For like the 30th time in the history of the nation of Israel, we have obvious corruption in the priesthood. We have what seems like sloth could easily also be greed. At the very least, it's some kind of unwarranted, unjustified delay, that there are needs. The temple doesn't necessarily need a new shiny gold thing added to it. It just needs upkeep. It needs repairing. God is not quiet about this. Why would you go on? He says, I believe it's in the book of Obadiah. Why would you go on living in nicely roofed houses while my house remains desolate? Now, that's a different era, I know. But it's one, I think, poignant example in the biblical stories that shows God sees the juxtaposition of our interests. He knows when we care about his, I wouldn't call them needs, but the things of him, and when we rather care about our preferences, what we want, what we get away with, you know? And with a righteous king like Joash, we have two primary problems. The first of which is while he himself is doing what's right in the eyes of the Lord, the people don't seem to be following the way of the king. There are still high places. There are still sacrifices and burnt offerings and incense offered to idols under his reign. So clearly there's a disconnect between the righteousness of the leader of the nation and the unrighteousness of his people. Second, it seems that money has pooled up in one spot. Money from different sources that came in for different reasons are just sitting and doing nothing. And this, I think, is one of the biggest things worth talking about today. In the realm of macroeconomics, I understand that there are several theories, hotly debated theories, about what works best, what kind of economic system is designed with the well-being of the most people in mind, and how we can best allocate resources. And I won't propose to you which one I think is best among them. But I will say a common denominator that every macroeconomic system holds is this very, very, very simple belief: money is like blood. In the body of a living organism, blood does no good when it stays in one place. It has to move. For us specifically, it's because blood carries oxygen to all the cells in the body. And there's no other way for oxygen to get where it's going except to move by the blood. Similarly, money, this brilliant tradition that's almost as old as the Bible, it's about 5,000, maybe up to 6,000 years old, started out as just real things of value. You need food? I have food. You need timber for building your house? I have timber for building your house. All right, let's try and figure out a good exchange rate between, you know, 20 pounds of wood and a few sacks of flour. That was pretty difficult, though. And eventually people realized that the things that they had of value wouldn't always be of value. They needed to trade on some kind of mediator. And so they turned to precious metals or pearls found in the ocean, things that are hard to find, because value is typically, in this case, determined by a shortage of it. And then they use these precious metals like gold and silver, these pearls and diamonds and special jewels, as signifiers of things of real value: food, timber, animals, livestock, land. And through embedding our kind of sentimental value on these precious metals, we are able to move value back and forth much more easily. This is great for empires, because when you can control the standard of what people give back and forth by stamping your name, your plate, your insignia, the name of your leader, your empire, when you control all of that, you're able to assess better where value in the empire is going, and you're able to artificially inflate or deflate it. Now, you all know in recent years in various countries, the most recent of which is now in Israel, as a result of the war, and even last year as a result of protests for and against Bibi Netanyahu, that inflation between currencies spikes back and forth. And even within our own countries, inflation sometimes shows up overnight and decimates your savings. Something that could have carried you through for basic needs for 10 years might, after some horrible economic disasters, the same amount of money can't even get you through a month. This should tell us something shocking about currency, and it's that there's no intrinsic value. The real value is in everything else in the world, and especially now in the digital age. The real value is what that thing represents, and it's changing all the time, even though the things of value haven't changed at all. It's a fragile system, and geniuses are trying to keep it from breaking every day of our lives. And yet we know from financial disasters all over the world that we don't always keep it at bay. So what's the big common denominator between these systems and the way we try and govern them? I believe it's the simple principle that things need to move. Blood has to get around the body. Money and the value it represents needs to move. I can tell you from my own personal life, for whatever reason, maybe it's because I'm a hoarder, a pack rat, or something, I will cook in bulk, like a batch of rice that should last multiple weeks, or chicken or lentils or something. And I think, okay, I've wasted 3.5 hours cooking today, and now I can set all that aside. And when I need it next week or in a few days, I can come back to it. And a few days go by, or a week goes by, and I go look at it and I'm like, well, you know, I made that for the future in case I'd need it. I don't need it now. And a few more days go by. And before I know it, 2-3 weeks go by and the food is spoiled because I didn't make use of it. I stored it all up and it lost its value. It wasted away. Jesus tells us a parable about a man who did something similar, building a second barn even to store even more of his grain in, and yet God required his life that very night and he never saw. Jesus also tells us the parable of three servants, various versions between the talents and the minas. And you remember the wicked servant. I used to wonder why they called him a wicked servant. He just seemed like a scaredy cat. But we're told that one of them, he simply buried the money in the ground. And when the master comes back and says, come on, you knew that I'm a harsh man. Like he owns it. He says, you know that I reap where I do not sow. Why didn't you put it in a bank for investment? As a kid, I used to think, gosh, really, this guy's a jerk. Like we're talking with like a shrewd, heartless businessman that cares more about, you know, making 0.5% interest than, you know, than having a good relationship with a servant. But clearly I was missing the point, because the point isn't the master's shrewdness. The point is that the servant decided to take something of value and remove it from the equation, ruining its value. If that money were never dug up, it would hurt more than help. And even as it is, when it's stashed away, when it's taken out of the system, and it's not moving around to actually help someone, it's about the worst thing we can do. At least the worst thing we can do with that thing of value. And so here we have again, in our Haftarah for today, this connection between the command for everyone in Israel, well, all the men 20 or older, to give a half shekel. That's kind of an accounting for their status in the community as members of this nation. It levels the playing field between rich and poor. And it's connected here to the calling of money, both in the census from verse 4, it's our most literal connection, but also money received from personal vows and brought voluntarily to the temple. Again, this mimics other scriptures. In fact, thank you. I believe it's John who just saved the day and brought us to Exodus 36, verses 2 through 7. This is what I was looking for and foolishly had not highlighted. Verse 2, then Moses summoned Bezalel and Oholiab and every skilled person to whom the Lord had given ability and who was willing to come and do the work. They received from Moses all the offerings the Israelites had brought to carry out the work of constructing the sanctuary. And the people continued to bring freewill offerings morning after morning. So all the skilled workers who were doing all the work on the sanctuary left what they were doing and said to Moses, the people are bringing more than enough for doing the work the Lord has commanded to be done. Verse 6, then Moses gave an order and they sent this word throughout the camp. No man or woman is to take anything else as an offering for the sanctuary. And so the people were restrained from bringing more because what they had already brought was more than enough for the work. I want us to sit with that for just a moment. How many religious groups do you think are saying, please stop giving, you've given plenty, we're done? It would be a nice testament to honesty. And I do believe it exists. In fact, if I can be so bold to share a parallel today, many of you probably know that Christchurch intends to be a good force in the lives of its neighbors here, particularly through the Mercy Fund. And while I don't know all the ins and outs of it, I know the general picture we've gotten is worldwide support for the Mercy Fund has exponentially increased since the start of the war, because people hear about, from their various contexts, they hear about the travesty of this war between Israel and Hamas and Gaza. And they think, oh my gosh, someone's suffering. Someone needs to be there helping. I know these people. I know they want to help. I'm going to give to them. And thank God, generous hearts all over the world are giving to the Mercy Fund. But at the same time, and not detracting at all from their selflessness and their love to help, at the same time, our general fund is being redirected from with some of these gifts. Specifically, I have friends in the States who are giving in their Good Friday donation from their church in America. They're giving to the church. And I said, thank you so much. The Mercy Fund is doing really well now, actually. But, you know, just to keep the lights on around here, to keep, you know, things going on, the general fund could really use your help. And they're like, yeah, of course, I'd love to. They take it back to their friends and they say, no, we're only going to give to the Mercy Fund. And I promise, I'm still grateful. I'm glad that they're giving. And we will make sure to use it right. But it reveals to me maybe one last thing I'll kind of end on. And that's that when a person is compelled to give, whether it's by a swindler, whether it's by a heartfelt, pressure, something weighing on the heart to solve a problem, to fix, we typically give towards the good vision of what we want to see, not particularly towards the bad things that need help. That might be kind of hard to understand, but I think they're different. We're not giving because malaria is a disease that needs to be eradicated. We're giving because we imagine a world without it, and we can see ourselves helping do that. But what if we can't imagine ourselves actually fixing malaria? What if we can't imagine ourselves actually changing things? Do we deflate? Do we decide, okay, well, then I'm going to go push where there's already momentum. I'm going to give where it's more effective. This is exactly what happens when it comes to caring for persecuted minority Christian groups in the Near East. A nonprofit that I'm very familiar with routinely brings people to this side of the world from the Americas and Europe. And they have, if I can say frankly, blown more money on me than I have made of my own volition, my own hard work in many years. I mean, these trips they take people on, and they've taken me on several times, are ridiculous, in fancy hotels, at restaurants I could never afford to eat out on my own. And at some point, I pulled the leaders of these groups aside and said, why are you spending all this money? We're not asking for a nice hotel. We're not asking for a fancy meal. We asked specifically to have like a less expensive stay here and just better get to know people on the ground. And part of the answer that came back to me was, listen, I have been speaking from the behalf of these guys working in the space. I've been begging Western Christians for 15 years now to give to help Christians in the Near East. I have been holding up the pictures and telling the stories of people who are suffering. And in a single 30-minute phone call with one donor, I raised 4 times more than I have in 15 years of begging. And what was the difference? With this donor, I said that we're bringing the future leaders of America to the Near East to see the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, to grow in their faith, to become better leaders for that. And donors love that stuff. The big movers are moved easily by things like leadership development, because they can see real change in that vision. But you tell them the Coptic Christians of Egypt are still suffering under the Muslim Brotherhood in Lower Egypt? Yeah, they always have. They give almost nothing. There's a huge difference between the heart that wants to help and the hands that actually do. And I think from our scriptures tonight, we can see a little bit of this difference. Money, when it's given purposelessly or aimlessly, or if it's held up by corruption, people with deep pockets, people who are swindling you, money getting pooled up in the wrong spot is like a blood clot in the body of the economy. It doesn't do any good. In fact, it really hurts. But also money going in any direction by people who just, you know, want to help it at whatever they can imagine the world looking like is not necessarily the needs of the temple. Imagine if that had played out in 2 Kings 12. If instead of repairing the temple, they just kept adding another gold thingy on top. This is what happens when we either give in the wrong direction or refuse to give, or worse, abuse others who give. So I ask again, and I end, why is it so hard to talk about money? Because there are so few things to say that won't upset someone you love. Money makes us weird. You talk about giving food to someone for a meal. Great. Talk about giving the raw money that could go buy that meal. And suddenly we're hit with all the moral conundrums. What if they use it on drugs? And what if they do this or that? What if I can't co-sign everything that I affect? Honestly, we affect everything around us. And yet for some reason in the life of the believer, there seems to be a stigma that attaches itself to money in a way that blinds us to healthy giving, to loose-handed but serious giving. And that's a stigma that I can't put my finger on fully. And believe me, I wish I could tell you that I figured out how to fix it, but that's what you guys are here for. I'd like to open now to discussion. What do y'all think? How do we reclaim a healthy and helpful vision of the things we steward, particularly in the form of money?
Thanks for joining us in the scriptures today. You may have noticed that it sounds like this podcast is part of a larger discussion on those scriptures. Well, that's because it is. We welcome you to join us live each Tuesday evening at 9 p.m. Jerusalem time for our online Bible study of Kings and Prophets, Voices from the Haftarah. You can find the sign-up link at our social media pages at Christ Church Jerusalem. This podcast has been a production of Christ Church Jerusalem and CMJ Israel. We'd like to thank our teachers, producers, and most of all, our friends who make this Bible study a joyful endeavor week to week. And in fact, we hope to see you next week. Until then, blessings from Jerusalem.